This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The spiritual life is living in a two-dimensional sort of way. This is a threat which applies not only to people who are living in the secular world and operating in the secular world, but even to people who are operating fully in the religious world. The big problem is that one starts becoming two-dimensional. Now, it's very difficult to describe to you what I mean by two-dimensional, but I think you know what I mean. When there's a lack of richness, there's a lack of color, there's a lack of soul, there's a lack of feeling, a lack of atmosphere. It's all just, there's no depth. It's like looking at a picture that doesn't have depth. It's all there. Now, if you look at a three-dimensional picture, the three-dimensional picture has no more than the two-dimensional picture has. There's no figure in the two-dimensional picture that you see better even in the three-dimensional picture. There's nothing in the three-dimensional picture that you can't see in the two-dimensional picture. But what is a three-dimensional picture? It's a third dimension that changes everything. Everything looks different. There's nothing you can see extra, and yet nothing looks the same. That's the concept of a third dimension, the dimension of depth. And without that dimension, it's a bit shallow, it's weak, it's inhuman. It's just not real, it's not human. It's like the difference, I suppose, between a very dry black and white photograph and a brilliant painting by a clever artist, by a skillful artist. The one has life to it, the one is a living thing. It has depth, it has personality, it has dynamicism. And the other is a stagnant piece of black and white paper. And so it is in life, not just Yiddishkeit, life in general. There are the two-dimensional livers and the three-dimensional livers. And it's not as if one's always one or the other. There are times in one's life and times in one's day when one is living in the three-dimensional basis, and there are times when one is living in a two-dimensional basis. But unfortunately, the bulk of it is two-dimensional. We lack religious depth. That's what it is. It's a total lack of religious depth. It's superficiality. We don't feel deeply. We don't get excited. We don't get terribly sad about things spiritual. What do we get sad about? You know, somebody pinched your car, you get sad. It's like a little baby. Somebody pinches the baby cries. Somebody took your car, you cry. The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, you don't even know about it. Tisha B'Av, you sit on the floor, you don't cry. Big boys don't cry. Two-dimensional, so you go through your whole Tisha B'Av process in a two-dimensional sort of way. You do everything that has to be done, you don't feel that much different. And the Shabbos comes, and there's a concept of Simchas Shabbos, of enjoying a Shabbos. Do you really enjoy a Shabbos? We enjoy a good movie. We enjoy a Saturday night party. To enjoy a Shabbos. Yeah, Shabbos is nice and pleasant and all the rest of it. Don't really enjoy it. It's two-dimensional Shabbos. And so it is with everything we do. We learn. But how do we learn? We lounge around a little bit with our knees crossed, and we look and we read and we hear a bit and we revise a little bit. And how much of the time that we spend in Chavrusa is spent learning, and how much of it is spent chatting and talking? It's two-dimensional learning. It's not three-dimensional learning. And throughout the religious world, we're afflicted with this problem, which is a problem of the Western world today in general. The total lack of richness, of color, of depth in everything we do. And one sees it on a person's face. That's one of the easiest things to tell on a person's face. There are many things one can tell on his face, but one of the easiest is three-dimensional or two-dimensional. Most people go around with this very zombie sort of look on their face, even when they're excited. They're excited like you would imagine a zombie getting excited. Can you imagine a zombie getting excited? I can! He's excited, but still it's like a zombie. It's an excited zombie. But an excited human being, a man whose eyes are sparkling with excitement, whose whole face is alight, like we learned last week with Moshe Rabbeinu. How often do you see that? How often? Occasionally a Rosh Hashiva will come around collecting funds and you'll see it. Occasionally, very occasionally in the secular world, you'll see it. But not in day-to-day life, you just don't see it. And really, we should experience this at every turn. That's the concept of saying a brocha, really. A brocha is an outburst of exhilaration. That's what it really should be. To see an apple that you're about to eat should turn you on. To the point that your only outlet for all that energy and for all that excitement is to say a borei priya, to say a brocha. To see a Talmid Chacham, you should be so enamored and so overwhelmed and so excited that you don't know what to do. All you can do is say a brocha. That's an outlet for that excitement. That's what a brocha really is. You see a rainbow, you hear thunder, you see lightning, you sit down at a meal, you bench at the end of the meal. These are all expressions of exhilaration. How do we bench? And if we vary from, but exhilaration, excitement, thrill. Where do you see it? That's not a bracha, and that's not three-dimensional religion. That's two-dimensional religion. More two-dimensional religion, or less two-dimensional religion. From a two-dimensional religion, or less from two-dimensional religion. But what we're trying to look for is that third dimension, to try and understand that depth and that richness, to capture it and to live it, because that's what it's all about. So the concept of the third dimensional in Torah, the word we use to describe the third dimension in living, is the concept of tahara. Tahara, purity. That is the concept of three-dimensional living. What do we mean by tahara? Tahara is one of the midos, in fact. Tahara is one of the attributes in the spiritual climb to perfection. One of the stages one goes through is the stage of tahara. And the Masilas Yeshorim devotes a couple of chapters to the definition of tahara and the description of tahara. Basically, tahara is when a human being does what they do in a mind with an awe. See and understand what effort goes in to taking that sand that they pull out, that stone that they pull out of the ground, and turning that into gold or lead or zinc or chrome or anything. There are little spots of it. If you look at a piece of a rock of chrome, it's a big black rock that sparkles. If you look, you see little spots, flickers of it, like that glitter stuff, a little few spots of glitter on the rock, and you think to yourself, my goodness, they're going and they're digging out this rock, which weighs a pound, to get a couple of milligrams of this stuff. But they do, and they start the refining process, and they refine, and they re-refine, and they re-refine, to try and get as much of the black stone out, to be left with as much of the silver stuff. And gold, take out huge, I don't know what the ratio is, but there are figures for it. What they take out compared to the bulk of the sand and stone that they take out compared to the actual gold they get out. So work and work and work to do what? Such a small part of mining technology is actually getting it out of the ground. That's the grub part of mining. That's the part that you don't have to be terribly clever to do. To dig it out of the ground is not where the brains come in. The brains come in to find the method of purifying, getting rid of the stone, getting rid of the sand. That's the concept of tahara. Refining, purifying. Tahara, says the Mesidus Yeshorim, is the purification of an action. And one has this both in actions and in objects. Let me give you an example. We're used to looking at the things around us in terms of their tzura, their form, their appearance. That's two-dimensional. We don't look at what it's really made from. We don't look at its content. We don't look at what goes into it. You see a piece of gold jewelry, and you say, that's beautiful. It's really a beautiful piece of gold jewelry. But it doesn't enter your mind what's gone into the production of that gold. At most, what you're admiring, if you're already sensitive, is the design of the piece of jewelry. If you're not even sensitive, you'll just say it's nice because you're flattering the lady who's wearing it. If you're a little bit more sensitive, you'll say it's nice because it's got some nice stone set in it. If you're still more sensitive, you'll notice the more refined things, a little bend in the piece of jewellery, the way its shape is slightly unusual, and you'll admire that. That's if you're very sensitive aesthetically. But that's not spiritual sensitivity yet. Spiritual sensitivity is to see, when you admire that piece of gold, to be seeing and admiring what went into that gold from the time it was dug out of the ground. And nobody can understand that better than people living in this country. One of the important things, and Shlomo HaMelech says that the learning of Torah is compared to the mining of precious stones. The effort that needs to go into the learning of Torah is the same as the effort that needs to go into the mining of precious stones. And realize that part of the effort is expressed in money. Right? Work out what money is going into the mining of precious stones, and translate that into man hours, and that tells you how hard you've got to work to understand a little piece of Gemara. Let's say one piece of Gemara, one sugi of Gemara, let's say, equals one bar of gold. Work out what went into the production of that bar of gold. That will give you an idea of how many hours you need to put in to understand the sugi properly, really properly. That's what Shlomo HaMelech says, and he knew. And certainly when one's looking at gold itself, one has to understand fully what goes into the production of that piece of material that one's admiring. Tahara, when one's looking at the surface of the object, when one's looking at the design of the piece of jewelry, the concept of tahara doesn't come into it at all. This is what I mean by three-dimensional. You have a person admiring an object, a person relating to an object, and the concept of tahara plays no part whatever. It doesn't come into his mind at all. It doesn't come into his emotions at all. And yet tahara is a world of feeling. It's a world of appreciation. It's a world of depth from which he's totally disassociated. When does the quality of tahara come in? Imagine that you'll be told that this piece of gold jewelry, apart from looking very pretty, was dug out one day by a big Talmid Chacham who needed a bit of money, and he went and he was digging, he was working as a labourer, and he found this piece of gold, and it was taken. He didn't want to take it to any ordinary goldsmith, and he took it to a very special goldsmith who was great man in Torah and Yerushalayim, Reb So-and-so, and that man understood who it was that he was working for and what he put into it. And you see what went into this little piece of jewelry behind. That's where tahara can or cannot come in, but at least the concept of tahara comes in. You can have a piece of gold that has nothing behind it but the story of Anglo-American, and you can have a piece of gold that has a great deal of human feeling behind it. And even the gold from Anglo-American has a great deal of human feeling behind it. Who knows what went up in the heart, what went on in the heart and the soul of the miner who was digging this out with the sweat pouring down his face? Who knows whether he wasn't Moser Nefesh to get this piece of gold out? Who knows if he didn't give his life to get this little piece of gold out, which you happen to be admiring now on somebody's arm or somebody's finger? And who knows what went on in the designing rooms? The person who designed this piece of jewelry and what he did and how many late hours he might have been sitting up at night going without sleep trying to perfect this design until he got it right. That's what goes into a little article. And by just viewing it superficially, one's cutting out that third dimension altogether. It's two-dimensional living. What a beautiful bracelet, Mrs. So-and-so. It's two-dimensional. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what went into this bracelet. You've got no concept and no idea. Want to be two-dimensional? Yes, it's a beautiful bracelet. That's not what it's all about. Says the Rambam, in the end of the first chapter of Hilchos Beis HaBechira, he's talking about the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, the utensils used in the Beis HaMikdash, and he says, Ein osin kol hakelim mitchiloson ela l'shem HaKodesh. You don't make any of the kelim for the Beis HaMikdash to start off with, excepting for the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash. And if you started off by manufacturing them for an ordinary person or for ordinary use, they can never be used for the Beis HaMikdash again. It's an incredible concept. You take an item which has been made for regular use, even for use by a big Talmid Chacham. Say, I design whatever it is, I start off designing something for a big Talmid Chacham, making something for a big Talmid Chacham, then I find that the specifications are suitable to something required in the Beis HaMikdash, and I bring it to the Beis HaMikdash. They've got to say, sorry, we can't accept it. Why? I'm a frum guy, I did it, I never worked on Shabbos, everything's 100%, the materials are mine, nothing stolen. When you live with a third dimension, the Beis HaMikdash requires absolute tahara. And there's the slightest lack of tahara, there's a little bit of sand mixed up in that gold. You haven't got the last drop of sand out if it wasn't made specifically for the Beis HaMikdash. There is nothing in that Beis HaMikdash that wasn't designed and made for the Beis HaMikdash specifically. It's an incredible thing. The Vilna Gaon and many Gedolim, both Hasidish and Misnagdish Gedolim, used to spend a lot of time out in forests. That was when they used to live three-dimensionally. When they live two-dimensionally, they never go out of town. And they think that going into a forest is bittul Torah, it's a waste of time. But the Gedolim, until the war, used to spend a lot of time outside in forests They used to give shiurim out of town. They used to learn out of town. And sometimes for months they used to go out of town. They used to take a little house out in the forest, and that's where they used to learn. And the reason is based on the Zohar, that nature can't be spoiled. If you're sitting and learning under a tree, that's fine. If you're learning in a house, who knows who built the house? Who knows for what purpose the house was used? Who knows who made the bricks? Maybe they were made on Shabbos by a Jew. That wouldn't bother you and I, because we live two-dimensionally. But it bothers a Vilna Gaon. He's afraid that will affect his learning. He's actually afraid that he won't be able to understand the Chazal properly, because he's surrounded by something which is not 100% pure. So he spends a lot of time learning outside. Outside you're okay. What can happen? What can go wrong? It's made by the Ribono Shel Olam. You know, one has it in one's own little ways. One has it on a much more, in a much coarser effect. I remember when we were looking for a house, we found just the right house, right near the Beit HaMedrash. Beautiful, very, very reasonably priced. It could have been designed for us. It was incredible. I walk in there and I can't work out what's going on. So I say to the agent, where's the bedroom? I said, here. I looked, something just didn't seem right. So I started questioning, what's the name of the couple? So I see the agent getting a bit agitated, and tells me the name. I said, have they got children? See the agent getting even more agitated. I said, what's wrong? He said, they're homosexuals. Thank you, goodbye. I can't live in a house where homosexuals have been living. Why not? It's just a house, and I'll sanctify it, and I'll make it more spiritual. Let somebody else do that. I can't. That's on a very coarse level, and one can take that down to refinements and refinements and refinements until you've got a man like the Vilna Gaon who can't learn in a house in case there's one brick in that house that wasn't made with the right intention. One piece of material in that house that didn't belong to the man who built it. One window frame that was put in by a poil, by a workman who wasn't giving of his time properly to the balabos. With intentions that might have been built, the whole house might have been built with intentions to use for things which don't tie up and don't complement the purpose that he's using it for at the moment. That's when you're living on a three-dimensional basis. There are things under the surface which become important to you. It's not just the surface itself. And that's when life becomes fun. And that's when Yiddishkeit becomes fun. That's when it becomes rewarding and fulfilling. Until then, it's a drag. Really a drag. And the tragedy is that we all get into the drag, and we very seldom get out of it. The way that the educational system normally works is that the drag takes place before the child is able, in any event, to live on a three-dimensional basis. The drag is at 5 years old and at 10 years old. By the time the child is between 15 and 20, and the child starts developing the ability to live three-dimensionally, the drag's over. He knows the whole of Shas already by heart. He knows all the dinim, he knows all the halachas. Now he can start living spiritually with a third dimension. But we face this massive problem in our generation, where people are coming into Yiddishkeit at later ages, and even those who've been in Yiddishkeit all their lives at the age of 20 don't know terribly much and still have to spend a lot of time grinding stones and just learning basics. Nevertheless, it is possible to combine the two. It is possible to obviously conquer ground in terms of technical knowledge, but always watch out that one doesn't lose the ability to live on a three-dimensional basis. On the contrary, that one's Torah is giving one the ability to live on a three-dimensional basis. And in fact, this concept of nature being pure, nature being toho, is the concept of the mikveh. What is a mikveh? You know, water you take out of the tap, who knows what's in it? Who knows where it comes from? Who knows who it was made by? Who knows what's been put into it and taken out of it? You don't know what you're drinking. No way do you know what you're drinking. Mikveh water is rainwater or spring water. Nothing can be wrong with it. It's made by the Ribono Shel Olam. What can be wrong? It's tahor. It's pure. And although a regular mikveh in town is not always 100% rainwater, it is water which can satisfactorily be regarded by halacha as rainwater. That's the definition of a mikveh. Water which halachically fulfills the conditions of being called rainwater or spring water. Not something which is natural. And the idea is that after a period of tumah, one is enveloped by total tahara. Tumah is the opposite of tahara. Tumah is when there's wasted potential, where something that, where growth has stopped, basically. Death. All the cases of tumah, if you look at all the examples of tumah, it's examples where growth has stopped. Tyro is where growth is moving forward. But growth is not technical. Growth is third dimensional. You're not growing if you make a bigger two-dimensional picture. That's not growth. That's how a child grows. But once one's out of the child age, growth is by developing the third dimension. That's what one has to do. That's Tyro. Seeing what's under the surface and being particular about what's under the surface. It's not only in a sense of objects around and about one, but it's in a sense of actions as well. And Siddhas Yashorim says that Tyro is when you're already doing everything 100% according to halacha. We're not talking, it's the very first chapter of the Siddhas Yashorim deals with people who are not yet on the level of dealing of living 100% in accordance with halacha. But when it comes to the chapter of Tahara, we're already talking about somebody who is 100% meticulous about everything he does. It's absolutely al-pi Torah, absolutely in accordance with Torah. But what's a lack of Tahara? If part of the reason he's doing it is not quite right. He's not talking, chas v'sholem, about a person who's learning in order to get honor, or a person who's keeping mitzvahs in order to be regarded frum. But he's not even talking about that. He's talking about the guy is standing very nicely in davening with his eyes closed, and he hears somebody in the base of Midrash. Yankel is busy davening over there, and Yankel hears somebody walk into the base of Midrash and say, "Ah, look at Yankel davening, isn't that a pleasure, such a Yore Shemai." And then does he start davening, and does he start shokling? What is it? That extra little bit he's doing now is not for the Rebbe initially. That says the Mesillas Yesholim is a lack of tarif. Where there's one little bit which is not for the Rebbe Nisholem, it's not pure, not 100% pure. This is getting into the third dimension. You know, our horizons are such that one day, Mirtza Hashem, if we're keeping the whole Torah and we're doing everything that halacha requires of us, we'll consider ourselves frum in Mirtza Hashem, that such a day should come. Those are our horizons. That's how far we can see. The Torah is not even at the end of the Mesillas Yesholim, it's in the middle. This is just one of the levels one has to get to and get beyond, where there's nothing in one's mitzvah which is impure. Not one little bit of the mitzvah is for any reason other than the beauty of the mitzvah, the perfection of the mitzvah, and the ritzon, the desire of the Ribbono Shel. That's somewhere where one has to ultimately get. At least one has to see it there. One has to see that horizon. One has to be moving towards that. Otherwise we're messing around and we're never going to get there. The picture of Tumah, I would think, the picture of Tumah, I've seen it. Picture of Tumah is, I've seen it at the Ram show sometimes, when you go around to the various halls and so on, you go into the furniture hall. Picture of Tumah is when you come into the furniture hall that deals with bedroom furniture, and they show you a bedroom suite with mirrors all over the place. But that to me is the picture of the depths of Tumah, the society in which we live. I don't know why, but if you ask me to tell you what the symbol of Tumah is, that to me would be the symbol of Tumah. Imagine then how Moshe felt when he needed some copper to build the kiyah. That's what they brought him, mirrors from their bedrooms. If I felt like I did when I was looking for a house and I heard that some homosexuals lived in it, imagine what Moshe felt when he's building a Beis HaMikdash for the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's building a Mishkan, and what do they bring him? They take down the copper mirrors from their bedrooms, and that's what they bring. So he throws it out. He refuses to accept it. And he's right. A lack of tahara. A lack of perfection. A lack of... There's just a few grains of sand still there. He can't let that into the Beis HaMikdash. That's it. But the Ribbono Shel Olam rebukes him. It tells him that that's not so in this case. Let's look at the Rashi. It says, "Vayat et hakiyor nechoshet ve'et kanon nechoshet." The kiyor, don't forget, the kiyor is now the urn which contained the water, for which was used for two things. Firstly, for the netilas yodayim v'raglayim, washing the hands and feet of the kohanim before they came into the Beis HaMikdash. And secondly, in the case of a sota, if a woman was suspected of being unfaithful, it was water from that urn that she was made to drink. Those are the two functions of the kiyah. And he made it b'marot hatzovos asher tzovu petach ohel moed. He made it with the mirrors of the tzovos which they brought before the ohel moed. And it says Rashi, says Unkelus further, first of all, Marot HaTzevos, B'mechezias Meshaya, with the mirrors of the women. I want to show you how easy it is to misunderstand and misquote a Chazal also, because there's a big machlokes here between Rashi and the Ibn Ezra. Says Rashi, quoting the Medrash Tanchumi, "Benot Yisrael hayu b'yadan maros." The daughters of Israel had these mirrors, sheroyes bohen kishehen mitkashtes, but they used to spend time sitting in front of when they made themselves up. The af oison lo ikvu milahavi linidvas hamishkan, and even those mirrors, which were very important, the dressing table is a very important part of a woman's furniture, and even these mirrors they brought to the Beis Hamikdash when it was being put up. The Hayam Moes Moshe Bohen, and Moshe was despised. He found it despicable. He found it abominable. Mipnei she'asuyim le'yetzer hara, because they are made for yetzer hara. Now this one has to understand.
What does it mean they're made for yetzer hara? They're not made for yetzer hara. They're made to look at yourself in. A woman is expected to do herself up. She's expected to put up makeup. Imagine what one's wife would look like if she put on makeup without doing it in front of the mirror. It would be a mess. So pi halacha, there's no question that a woman is expected, in fact, to use a mirror, to use a mirror. In fact, there's a question whether a man is permitted to look into a mirror. Question halachically whether a man is allowed to look into a mirror, because it's considered something so effeminate. It is so much part of a woman that there's a question whether it's not effeminate for a man to look into a mirror. It's certainly effeminate for a man to look in a mirror for a long time. That's certainly, in fact, not according to halacha. It's against halacha. So one should keep one's hair fairly short, that one doesn't have to sit and spend a long time there and so on. Maybe that's why people grow beards, that they don't have to spend a long time shaving in front of the mirror, I don't know, but that's what it is. But as far as the women are concerned, there's certainly nothing wrong al pi halacha that a man should, that a woman should have a mirror. So what does it mean? Mirrors are made for the yetzahara? There's something symbolic about a mirror, which is the Yetzirah. What's that about a mirror that is so symbolic of the Yetzirah? It's two dimensional. It has no third dimension. It has no depth. It shows you nothing new. It gives you nothing that you don't already have. One thing you can see in that, and that's yourself. You can't see anything else except yourself in the mirror. You can't use it for anything else except to look at yourself. And that creates a circle of a vicious circle of self-centeredness. The mirror is the symbol of a man who can't see beyond himself. That's really what it is. Who hasn't got depth, who can't see depth, who doesn't want to see depth, all he wants to do is sit and look at himself all day. That's what the mirror is the symbol of, and therefore symbolically a mirror is a symbol of a yetzer. Moshe's not worried that the women sat in front of their mirrors doing their hair. They're expected to do that. They have to do that. Moshe is worried that the mirror symbolizes Yetzirah. The mirror symbolizes self-centeredness and two-dimensionalism. And while it's very good as a part of the furniture in a woman's bedroom, it's not the kind of thing that goes into a Beit HaMikdash. That was Moshe's reasoning. Om Alei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tablem, says the Ribbono Shel, receive those mirrors, take them. Ki Eilu Chavivim Olai Min HaKol, because they are more precious to me than anything else, says the Ribbono Shel. You know what they've brought? Precious stones from the Nesim, gold and silver, all these fancy things they've brought out of Mitzrayim, things that have been saved up for the Beis HaMikdash, things that have been treasured just to be able to build into the Mishkan. Says the Ribbono Shel, these little mirrors from the women's bedroom is more important and precious to me than anything else that the Beis HaMikdash is made of. This is the most important part. Why? She'al yadehim he'emidu hanoshim tzivoes rabos b'mitzrayim, because by use of these mirrors the women established large quantities of Jews in Egypt. They increased the population. K'shayu ba'aleim yegeim ba'avodas perech, their husbands used to come home broken from their hard work. Something that should always bother one: how is it possible that the Bnei Yisrael multiplied so quickly in Mitzrayim? That means, apart from the various miracles that took place, they must have had a fairly active sexual life. How is it possible with that work? Working, the torture, the heartbreaking hardship continuously. How is it possible that they developed that? with the women. And when their husbands used to come home tired and broken from their work, they used to go and fetch them food and drink, and they used to give them a party, and they used to take out the mirror, and they used to show each other in the mirror. They used the mirrors not to look at themselves. The woman used to say to her husband, look at you in the mirror, ha ha, look at you, you're a tired old man. And they used to encourage him with words, look how beautiful I am and look how ugly you are. And that used to arouse their husbands into a passionate intersexual relationship. And they used to live together, and they used to become pregnant, and they used to give birth. Says the Rebbeinu Shalom to Moshe, these mirrors are different. That's it. These mirrors are tahor. They've had the tahor. You're right that mirrors are made for Yetzirah. You're right that there's something essentially bad in a mirror. There's something symbolically bad in a mirror. It symbolizes that which is despicable to the Torah, really. And it's an essential part of a woman's furniture, and we don't ban them. On the contrary, it's got to be used correctly. But using it correctly is not yet tahara. Using it correctly is just.
I don't like it. What can I do?
It's all right. And purifying it, removing those little pebbles, removing those little grains of sand. Millionths of a millimeter in size, but still there, removing it, that's Tara. So says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, you're right, Alpi Halacha, you can't accept these mirrors based on the din of the Rambam. But it is possible to be metaher something, it is possible to raise something and purify something, it's possible to take a block of sand out of this ground and turn it into gold. Just by removing the sand, you don't have to do anything fantastic. You don't have to change, you don't have to go through any magnificent chemical process. Except to remove the impurity. Once you've removed the impurity, you're left with gold. And that's what the whole of a Torah life is. Once you've removed the impurity, you're left with gold. Once you've removed the harsh corners of your personality, once you've removed the little bits of grobkite, once you've removed the little bit of lack of refinement, you don't have to refine yourself. What does refining yourself mean? You don't have to work on yourself to make yourself great. You are great. Just get rid of the rubbish. Drop the hang-ups. Get rid of the coarseness. And you're left with something which is noble and pure and great. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't make anything which isn't great. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't make anything which isn't noble and refined and incredibly wonderful. Just sometimes it's covered with an awful lot of rubbish that has to be removed. And that's the process of living through a Torah life, little by little, to drop off that rubbish so that you're left with the essential ingredient. And that's what the Bnei Yisrael did. They took a mirror, which is a symbol of tumah, it's a symbol of that which is disliked by the Torah, and they got rid of it. They used that mirror, but not to look at themselves, to show themselves to their husbands and to look at their husbands in the mirror, to create relationship between two people, not to foster relationship with yourself. And through that they were metaher the mirrors, so much so that this is the only case where a specific donation was used for one object only. The gold and so on was all mixed up together, it was all melted, and the various things was made from all the gold. But the kiyor was made only from these mirrors. There was nothing else in the kiyor but these mirrors. And in fact, there's no measurement given for the kiyor. You're not told it must be so many feet high, and so many amas high, and so many tvachim wide. We're not told. However many mirrors there are, that's how much it's made. Not one mirror should be turned down, and not anything but the mirror should be added to it. The kiyor should be made out of nothing but these mirrors. That's incredible. So we see Moshe's reluctance to take the mirrors because of a lack of tahara. I'm going to use this kiyor in the Beis HaMikdash, and I'm going to think these mirrors come from these women's bedrooms. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's exactly what I want. Because look how they've used these mirrors. Look how they've taken something ordinary, and they've utilized them and built them into something fantastic. That's what I want in my Beis HaMikdash. What are they used for? It's used for washing the hands and feet of the Kohanim. The concept of washing the hands is taking something which is most physical. The hands and feet are the most physical part of the bodies, particularly the feet, but also the hands. The most physical part of the body. And that's why we wash them before we do something spiritual. In the case of the Kohanim, the feet as well. in our case at least, the hands. Before we do anything spiritual, we sort of wash the ordinariness off them, because the hands are always busy with physical things. They're always busy with practical things. They're not very intellectual, the hands. They're not very spiritual. And now we're going in to do something spiritual. You know, you almost feel like leaving your hands behind. If you can't, you need them, so at least you wash them. That's what the key is going to be used. Raising and sanctifying of something very physical into something very spiritual. That should be made out of the key. And here you see the third dimension. What's important about the key is not just what material it's made out of. It's not just its size and its shape and how it's used. Already, if one puts special kavona into how you use the key, that you would think is already a tremendous spiritual stature. Man comes and uses the key with all the kavonas before he washes. Imagine a kohen coming. Let's imagine what kind of stature are we talking about. So you can have the kohen who comes and opens the tap and washes and walks off and didn't even wash his hands properly. We're not talking about such a kohen. So you have the kohen who comes along now and is very careful to make sure that his hands are washed absolutely correctly according to halacha. He opens the kiyur, washes correctly, carefully. That's already a different kind of a kohen. Then you can have the third kohen, which in our two-dimensional life is the ultimate. He stands there for 5 minutes before he opens the tap of the kiyur, thinking, Hinani mechavim b'zeh, my intention in doing this is to wash my hands in order that I can serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. And these holy waters that come out of the kiyur inside the Beis HaMikdash, and what an honor it is for me that the Ribbono Shel Olam allows me to go into his Beis HaMikdash. And now I'm ready to do so. And then with full seriousness and kedusha, he opens the tap and he washes his hands. That's the ultimate that there can be in a two-dimensional life. In a third-dimensional life, there's all that. Plus, where does this water come from? From a kiyur. And what's the kiyur made from? Copper. And where does that copper come from? It's those mirrors that the Benos Yisrael used in Mitzrayim. That's a third dimension. The depth, historic depth, a relationship with those women, an understanding of the connection between what they did and what he's about to do. That's a third dimension. That's living with color. That's not frumkeit. It's got nothing to do with being frum and religious. It's got to do with being spiritual. That's something different. Being religious is something quantitative. It's how much you do. Being spiritual is how deeply you do it. It's a different concept altogether. But just before we conclude, the Ibn Ezra says something which could very easily be misunderstood, so I want to explain it too. The Ibn Ezra says that these mirrors were not the mirrors as Rashi describes them. V'hinei, he says, Hayu b'Yisrael nashim ovdos Hashem. There were some very frum ladies in Israel, shesaru mitava zeha elam, who withdrew themselves totally from the passions of this world, the nosnu maroseihem nedovo, and they gave their mirrors as a donation to the Beis HaMikdash, ki ein lahem tzorech od lehityapot, because they no longer need to make themselves beautiful, rak bois yom yom el petach ohel moed lehispalel belishma divrei hamitzvah. All they do is every day they come to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, and they stand outside to daven and to hear halacha, to hear shiurim, and so on. That's all they do. It's a bit funny. And the Ramban goes like the Ibn Ezra, and the Sipurna goes like the Ibn Ezra. Although Rashi is based on the Tanchuma, it's very easy to quote this Ibn Ezra and say, you see how evil it is to make yourself look nice, and therefore a woman should look like a shloch. It's part of being Jewish, part of being frum. A woman who makes herself nice is it's a factor of the sultan. It's his influence, and she really doesn't want to make herself nice for her husband. She really wants to attract other men, and therefore a woman should look as schlochy as possible. You see, the Ibn Ezra says so, that the highest level you can get is that you throw out your mirrors. That's the highest level you can get. Says so. I have to understand the Ibn Ezra. There's a step higher than Tahara. The next step after Tahara, not in the Mesillas Yeshorim, but nevertheless in the Brisa of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyer, the step after Tahara is Kedusha. Kedusha says that Mesillas Yeshorim is incredible. The most wonderful perek in the Mesillas Yeshorim is the last perek, which is the perek of Kedusha. He says, you know, a man who has Tahara is a man who does everything according to its correct requirements. In other words, a man who has Tahara will eat. He won't stop eating because eating is physical, but he'll eat as much as he needs to keep healthy. That's it. He won't eat sweets and chewing gum because that has no place in Torah, really. to eat sweets and chewing gum really has no place in Torah, so he won't eat it. We're not on that level yet, so we can eat it as long as we make a bracha and as long as it's kosher. But for a person of Tyro, it just has no place in his life. Chewing gum, sweets, chocolate, doesn't come in at all. So he'll eat what he needs to eat, and he'll sleep as much as he needs to sleep, and the rest of his life will all be dedicated to spiritual matters. A man who has Kedusha, his eating is not because he needs to eat. A man who has Kedusha, he is as close as one can get to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and he becomes a Mizbeach. He becomes an altar in a sense. And when he eats, it's not his body that's consuming the food. It's like a Mizbeach consuming the food. The man with Kedusha eats. When he sleeps, it's a totally different qualitative action. He brings various chazals. The chazal that says Kol HaNosen Doira, and I think it is Le Talmud Chochem. If a man brings a gift to a Talmud Chochem, food, Harek Ilu Makriv Al HaMizbeach, if he's bringing on the altar. What does it mean as if you're bringing on the altar? The Talmud Chochem likes to get lots of gifts of food. Don't forget the Talmud Chochem has already passed the stage of Tara and is now on the level of Kedusha. What does he need the food for? He doesn't need it, but you need to give it to him, because by him eating it, he is the highest level of Kedusha there can be. That's as close as you can get to giving something to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when he consumes it, it's as if the Ribbono Shel Olam himself is consuming it as he consumes things on a Mizbeach, as he consumes things on an altar. He brings the chazal of the two stones under the head of Yaakov, and the two stones started arguing with each other, each one saying, Alay Aniach Tzadik Esrosho, each one said, the Tzadik should rest his head on me, and they fought so hard until they merged into one stone. Right? Because Yaakov went to sleep with two stones under his head, and he woke up and it was only one stone. There too you see the importance to the physical world of the time, of the Kodesh, of the holy man, relating to it. In the case of the Tahor, in the case of the pure man, it's important because you're assisting him. It's the piece of bread which the Tahor eats is important because it's helping the Tahor man to learn and to keep mitzvahs and to help other people, and that's an important role performed by that piece of bread that was eaten. But when a Kodesh eats that piece of bread, it's as if it was brought from the Beis HaMikdash altogether. It's a level of Kedusha. And I must tell you, one day we'll learn the Mesilas Yesharim. I think when we finish the Chazonish on Shalosh Shudas, we'll start doing the Mesilas Yesharim. Although the Mesilas Yesharim goes in steps, and Kedusha is the last step, it doesn't mean that you don't get there until you've finished all the steps before it, because then one would really get very depressed. It means in every action, the first thing to concentrate on is the Zahiris, the next one is the Zrizis, the next one is the Precious, the next one is the Nakius, and so on. In each action there has to be a little bit of each. Obviously on the lower levels there will be mostly Zahiris, a little bit of Zrizis, a little bit less Precious, and so on and so forth. And the dot of Kedusha. It's possible. One needs to know the whole thing in order to try and bring these all into one's religious life, to make it deep, to make it rich and colourful. So here we're talking about a Kodesh, a man who has Kedusha. And this is the level when he eats, it's because he's raising the thing that he's eating. When he enjoys a sight, when he sees a beautiful sunset, when he benefits in any way, sits on a chair, leans on a table, what he's doing is he's raising the table, he's raising the chair, he's raising the sunset into something which is relating directly to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now imagine the Talmid Chochem is living in the time of the Mashiach. And he's used to this whole thing. Mashiach is about to come, and he's used to the system that if he is brought a gift, brought a challah before Shabbos, it's a big mitzvah to eat it, for him to eat it. It's a big mitzvah for the man who brought it to him, because the man has taken an ordinary challah, and by this Kodesh eating the challah is raised spiritually, and it's as if the other man brought a korban, as if he brought a sacrifice. So imagine the first Shabbos after Mashiach comes and the Beis HaMikdash is built, and somebody, the same guy, comes and brings him his regular Friday roast, brings him a sheep which can be shechted for Shabbos, and he always goes out of his way to shecht the animal so that the person should have this chus. He doesn't realize there's something else he could do. He could suggest to the man, now you don't have to bring it to me, now you can take it to the Beis HaMikdash, you can bring a korban, it's even better. Up till now you had to bring it to me because we had no Beis HaMikdash, but now you can do the real thing. Now imagine that those women that we're talking about were already on the level of Kedusha. Not Tahara, but Kedusha. So they use mirrors in their bedroom like everybody else does. But what is the purpose of using the mirrors? To raise the mirrors, like we discussed in the Rashi. But what happens if there's a possibility of actually using the mirror in the Beis HaMikdash? Then there's no need to make yourself beautiful anymore in terms of the mirror. There are other needs to make yourself beautiful, and don't think they went around looking like schlocks. But as far as the mirror was concerned, they had to make themselves beautiful in order to use the mirror. Are you with me? The Talmid Chochem, the Kodesh, had to eat the food, had to eat the food in order to give merit to the bread. He had to eat the meat in order to make it come out like a korban. He had to sit on the chair. That's how Kodesh thinks. I must sit on this chair in order to raise the chair. I mustn't just ignore it. I must use this table in order to raise the table. And so these women who were kedushas looked at those mirrors that they had and they said, we've got to use these mirrors in order to raise them. Our purpose in the world is to raise the material world around us. And we must make ourselves beautiful in order to use the mirrors. But when there's an opportunity to use the mirror in the Beis HaMikdash itself, up go the mirrors into the Beis HaMikdash. And what the Ibn Ezra is saying is not that these women stop making themselves beautiful, because that would be against halacha. They're not permitted to. If they are married women, they've got to make themselves beautiful, no matter how much time they spent at the Beis HaMikdash davening and praying. But what the Ibn Ezra is saying is that these are people that were kuli kedushos. These were people that were totally holy. There was nothing in their life except Torah and mitzvahs. They were people who were on the highest level of the Mesillas Yesharim system. And the whole purpose of the use of the mirrors in their own home was now superseded by the opportunity to use them for the kiyah. That was something much greater even than using them for themselves. And so what we have here is a machlokes between Rashi and the Ibn Ezra as to what brings, what should the kiyah be made of. The kiyah, as we said, has two functions. It has the function of washing the hands and legs of the hands and feet of the Kohen. It also has the function of sota, of clearing the name of a woman who has been suspected of immorality. What do you use to be metaher? Do you use things, do you use material which is on the level of tahara, which is according to Rashi? Rashi's whole thing is that these mirrors are the epitome of tahara. You've taken something initially impure and you've made it pure. That's what the water is really going to do, and that's what the kiyah should be made out of. The Ibn Ezra holds, you've got to make the kiyah out of something which is kodesh. In other words, what you're really arguing about is, does one push oneself up in spiritual endeavor, or do you pull yourself up in spiritual endeavor? Rashi says you're going to be metahir the hands and feet of the Kohanim, you're going to sanctify the hands and feet of the Kohanim. You should understand that these mirrors have come down all the way from being symbols of the Yetzer Hara. Up they've come, up, up, up. And now we can take them still further and use them in the kiyah. According to the Ibn Ezra, the mirrors are already on the level of Kedusha. They're already on a higher level than the purpose for which you're going to use the kiyah. You're going to use the kiyah for Tahara, not for Kedusha. And according to the Ibn Ezra, the function that the kiyah must be made out of something still more special than what the kiyah really is. Two methods in education. Pushing oneself from the bottom, pulling oneself from the top. It's not really a machlokas, they don't conflict. It's the same mirrors, after all. Rashi is based on a medrash. The Ibn Ezra wouldn't argue with a medrash. Eilev, eilev, divrei Elokim chayim. Both of them are true. It's necessary to build one's status up and to have underneath one a foundation which comes up to where you are now, and then try and strive a little bit further. But also you should have your eyes on a horizon which is beyond where you are at the moment, and pull yourself up towards it. And with those two together, one's able to reach the heights, hopefully one day, of Tahara and Kedusha.